All right, well, we have got another good episode for you of Out of the Blue podcast. We're coming to you live from Cave Country Canoes in Milltown. We've been doing a series of these once a month, and if you've missed them, you've missed them because we've had some good ones so far. This is going to be another good one today. I am your host, Michelle Hardman, and I have got three fine folks with me. Sherry Nail's here today. She is owner of Cave Country Canoes, and then we've also got Gary Robertson and Gordon Smith, who are former owners, and we're going to hear all kinds of history, and I can tell we're going to get some crazy stories out of these two, and so it's going to be a fun show. So, let's get going. How are y'all today?
Just fine.
Good.
Good. Thanks for coming in today. Thanks for coming in. I want to hear some history about, I know you guys are both long-time cavers. Tell me what you like about caving. How'd you get into that in the first place? Why caving?
Well, I crawled into a cave when I was 11 years old as a tenderfoot Boy Scout. That's how I got started.
And why were you hooked? What hooked you with that?
I don't know. It was just the adventure of it. And I mean, that seemed like a great thing. That was back in 1958. And so before that, I loved water, doing stuff like that. So there's the canoeing interest and stuff. But
were you supposed to be in the cave, or was it like, I ain't supposed to be here? So that's the draw to it.
Well, from the scoutmaster's point of view, we weren't supposed to be there. But anyhow, we did.
Uh-huh. And what was so cool about it to you? What was so fascinating?
Well, it was just, I mean, I'd never been in a, I don't think I, yeah, I'd been in Mammoth Cave on a lantern tour, because they still had lanterns back then before, but that was the only cave, and you just went, this was Lamplighter's Cave, and you went down through a little narrow slot, and at the bottom it was so tight you had to back your feet into like a kind of a little alcove to duck your head under and get in the crawlway, And I remember the first guy in our senior patrol leader, who was probably 13 or 14 years old, he had a Coleman lantern like this, and he got down in the backed in and started down to crawl, and we heard this big scream out up on top, and he had touched his lip on the lid of the Coleman lantern, and those were about 500 degrees or something, and so he burned himself really bad on that Coleman lantern, so it was exciting. We didn't know what had happened.
Yeah, something had him.
But we all followed him in and waded down the stream a ways. We didn't do anything dramatic, but later on, this is like, I was 11 then, so like 11 years later, I became the scoutmaster of that troop, and we had a big old case with all the stuff in it that you use for camping. And that lantern was in there, and it still had his lip print on the top of the thing. So that made a big memory for me. It's just great memories. And, I can still remember that today as if it was yesterday, really. It just made a real imprint.
So. And you've been caving ever since.
Well, I got started somewhat similar in the 50s. My parents took me to a show cave in West Virginia or Virginia, I forget which. Back in the mid-50s, and then I went to college in 1959, and I was in the dormitory one evening, and one of the other rooms was some geology students, and they were, on their shelf, they had a book called The Caverns of West Virginia, which they were studying for one of their geology courses, and I took it and started thumbing through it, and I had never imagined anything like that ever existing. And I asked them if they ever went in these caves, and they said, oh, occasionally we do. And I said, well, next time you go, take me with you. Mm-hmm. So the fall of 1959, I went in my first wild cave in Kaiser, West Virginia. And then pretty soon I was taking them in caves. It was just very exciting and very different and a great adventure. And then I went on from there to after I graduated from graduate school, I went to Louisville and started work with the Cave Research Foundation in Mammoth Cave.
People who have never been in a cave, they don't realize it's almost like its own little world underground, isn't it?
Yep, it sure is. Some people like it, some people don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things about a cave, if you're a caver like Gordon and I both were, is that it's one of the few places where you can go someplace where nobody else has ever been before.
It's discovery.
Yeah, it's the excitement of that, and you know, I mean, all the mountains, I think, have pretty well been climbed. And I guess you can go down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench or something and maybe get some, see something nobody else has ever seen, but that's about it.
What's the deepest that you all have been down below ground in these caves?
Well, depth probably not very far for either one of us, 100 feet or so, because we're not vertical cavers and we don't look for deep pits. On the other hand, horizontally, from the entrance, we've been many, many, many miles from the entrance horizontally in both caves like Wyandotte Cave and Mammoth Cave and Flint Ridge, which is also in Kentucky.
And caves around in Indiana and Kentucky are not particularly deep. You have to go to the areas where you have big mountains and stuff to get caves. And, the, you know, there's some pits down in Georgia in the Appalachian Mountains there that are, you can go straight down 500 feet. But around here, they're, you know, 100 and some odd feet is about it.
Mm-hmm. How did you all get to be business partners?
You get to tell
here
that
come
one.
The stories, I can tell.
Well, 1973... at a grotto meeting, a caving club meeting in Louisville, someone mentioned to me that, someone mentioned during the meeting that Marengo Cave was for sale. And I had been in Marengo Cave before, and I figured I'd better go out and take a look at it again. Not so much to buy it, certainly not to buy it, but they had some postcards for sale there that I wanted to purchase. And so I went out there, and while I was at Marengo Cave, I said to the owner, Jack Hollis, I said, I've heard this place is for sale. And he said, you better believe it is. He said, not only that, he said, we've recently cut the price in half. And I said, oh, wow, that's neat. I said, and he told me what the price was, and which amazingly was only $75,000 for the whole cave and all the land and everything. And I looked down over the hill and I saw there was a big swimming pool down over the hill with a lot of people and all in it. It looked like a really nice thing. And I remember saying to Jack, I said, well, certainly the swimming pool is not included in the $75,000. And he said, you better believe it is. So I knew right then the swimming pool was probably not a big profit generator, and it certainly wasn't. But at the time, I thought, wow, I didn't have a penny to my name. I had just bought my first home in my life, which I still own. And I didn't have a penny to my name, just recently married. And but I thought what I'd do is I'd find 9 other or 10 other close friends that were in the cave, were cavers, that had some money, and get them all together, and each one would put in 10%, and I'd manage the cave. Then I had a nightmare and thought that would be just terrible, because they'd all want some money and dividends and what have you, and I'd be responsible, and that wasn't going to work. So in talking to one of the 10 people that I talked to, Pat Stevens, friend of mine and friend of ours in Louisville, he said, well, don't get 10 people, just get a small number, get 3 or 4 here locally that can help work out there. I said, oh, that's pretty good. He said, yeah, like those guys out at Squire Boone Caverns that are managing and working and developing Squire Boone Caverns at that same time. So I said, wow, okay, that sounds pretty good. So got together with the 3 people at Squire Boone Caverns, which was Kenny Hoover, Terry Creighton, and Gary. And we went, I think, to a motel in Louisville and got a room. I think it was Executive Inn, if I'm not mistaken, and we got a room.
Really,
and I pitched to, Pat and I pitched to the 3 of them getting together and buying Marengo Cave. And Kenny Hoover quickly said no, he didn't want to do that. He said he'd seen enough of show caves. But Gary, on the other hand, and Terry Creighton said, yeah, that sounded like a pretty good idea. So Marengo Cave was born, and we all chipped in. I don't know where we got the money to chip in, but we got it somehow and purchased the cave.
I don't think any of us had any liquid assets to our name. We were all young. And, you know, I wasn't that long out of college, and but we borrowed the money from the English State Bank, and Irvin Farr was the president, and he had known my dad growing up, and I think Irvin, so he knew me, you know, or knew me from my dad, and he looked at Gordon and people with a college education, and Pat was had a steel company, and Terry had all kinds of skills, and he's, I think he just said, okay, these guys won't let me down, you know. And so he loaned us money, and then the part we had to come up with, we all borrowed it ourselves, I think, and put it in. So it was really 100% debt financing, both personal and from the bank. And that seems like nothing today, but interest rates were higher back then. And so it was, I mean, it was a lot more difficult. Most of the time we were developing that, we were paying 9.5% to sometimes as much as 11% interest. And it makes a big difference when you're trying to pay off a loan.
It was interesting at that time. We first went to the Marengo State Bank because the cave was right across the street, and they could see their collateral right out the window. We went to them, and they said I wanted to borrow $75,000 or whatever, and they looked absolutely incredulous and said that, wow, that may be okay, but there was no way that the Marengo Cave Bank could possibly come up with that much money. Mm-hmm. It's just totally out of their lending capabilities. So that's why we went to the English State Bank, and even there, the English State Bank couldn't come up with that much money. They mm-hmm. had to do a corresponding loan with the Corydon State Bank. Huh. So we had to use two banks to come up with the $75,000, which is, you know, amazing today when a car will cost that much money. But at that time, it was big dollars, big dollars.
One of the way I equivocate that, when we went to develop Squire Boone, they had 110 acres, and it was sold for $15,000. Wow. So, you know, 110 acres. So for $75,000, you could buy 500 acres back then.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And you were even talking about, at one point, they didn't have, was it kayaks? What were you talking about a while ago?
When the canoe rental came to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they were just, yeah, I mean, they were just getting into kayaks, but back when we were buying the cave, I mean, nobody was canoeing the river, or even, and nobody ever thought of whitewater rafting. I mean, that was far in the future.
Right. Mm-hmm. The canoe business came 10 years after the cave business was started. And by that time, Gary and I had purchased the interest of Terry Creighton and Pat Stevens. So it was just Gary and I at that point, in 1982 and 1983. And at that point, Dick Lambert was running this business as Murphy's Canoe Rental, and down the street, Paul Harp was operating Blue River Marina, as he called it. And Paul Harp's operation was much larger than Dick Lambert's at the time, and they competed, you might say, here in Milltown. And at Marengo Cave, we had a lot of groups, a lot of school groups, little Boy Scout groups, etc. And we would put together a package of cave exploring and canoeing with Murphy's Canoe Rental. Most of the time with Murphy's, I imagine we used Dick.
No, we just used Murphy's.
It was pretty much Murphy's with Dick Lambert. And then came the big drought of 83. The summer of 83 was a big drought. And Dick Lambert apparently was having financial problems, and as he would, as anyone would, from the drought. Mm-hmm. And I got to thinking, gee whiz, with all the business we're giving him in groups, maybe we should be in the canoe business. And Gary and I put our heads together and mm-hmm. came up with a plan to borrow the money and buy Dick Lambert out. One of the interesting things was that Marengo Cave at the time was struggling and had an SBA loan. We originally planned to just have one company that would own both the cave and the canoe. But because the cave had an SBA loan, we couldn't get another loan for Cave Country Canoes. So we started a separate company, Cave Country Canoes LLC, to buy Cave Country Canoes from Dick Lambert. Okay. So that's why it's not part of just part of Marengo Cave. And it turned out to be good we did that way.
Yeah. And I mean, the way it was working in Milltown then, with two people up down the street competing, Paul Harp had been the original person to start renting canoes, and he had a really good operation. He did a first-class job for that time, and of course Dick Lambert had the canoe rental up at Fredericksburg first, and then he bought out Curtis Murphy, who had Murphy's Canoe down here, and his operation was not nearly as good, and which we really found out in spades when we bought it, because he had all these flat bottom smoker craft canoes with ribs and rivets, and all the rivets had worn off on the rock ledges in the river in that first winter. I think I put 100,000 rivets in the bottom of canoes just to keep going, and so it was an interesting start, a shoestring thing. But the way we did it was when we came in, Dick had always been the low cost leader. He undercut Paul to get business because he didn't have quite as good an operation, and so Gordon and I knew we couldn't do that and pay the loan to buy it. So I went down, I just said to Paul, I said, Paul, this is what our price is going to be. Just letting you know, we're not going to be undercutting you in price or anything. And so we had the same price the year we competed against each other in 84. And then we were friendly competitors. Mm-hmm. And Dick, I don't think, and Paul were probably that friendly competitors. I don't really know their relationship. But then Paul came after the 84 and he said, hey, you want to buy me out? So, by being friendly to him and all, it worked to our advantage. And then once we got both of them, there was not the competition.
Going back to the rivets in the bottom of the canoes, we knew that we were in trouble when Dick Lambert would carry a caulking gun in his back pocket with a tube of silicone at all times. And when any time a customer complained about a leak in a canoe from a rivet, Dick would whip out his caulking gun with his silicone in it and shoot a shot of silicone into the rivet to fix the canoe. And we should have known right then we were in trouble. But, of course, back then there was only aluminum canoes. There was nothing, no plastic canoes and no kayaks whatsoever. Another problem was that we were friends with Paul Harp. But even there, we had problems. For example, I remember one time distinctly where a company in Louisville called us and said they were going to wanted to rent 20 canoes that particular Saturday. And they wanted to play volleyball after they got done with their canoe trip and wanted to make sure we had a volleyball net up and a brand new volleyball for them. And well, we went out and bought a net and strung it up out back here and had the volleyball. Well, a couple of days later, the guy that ran the company, he said to another secretary, call that canoe company and tell them we want 25 canoes, not 20 canoes. Well, the other secretary, she didn't know which one. Well, she called Paul Harp, thinking it was the one canoe company. And she calls Paul Harp and said, we're bringing 25 canoes, and you're going to have that volleyball net up for us, right? And the volleyball. Paul said, oh, yeah, we'll have a volleyball net up. And well, come Saturday morning, here come all these people into town. And we were the 20 canoes. That was big business back then. Yeah. So we knew they were ours. And, of course, Paul Harp knew they were theirs. So even under the best of circumstances, things could go downhill quickly.
Yeah.
And we got it straightened out, and I think half went to us and half went to Paul. But probably played volleyball at their facility because theirs was a lot better than ours, as I recall. But we didn't like competing with Paul, and Gary and I got together and made an offer to Paul, and he accepted it. So all of a sudden we were one big canoe lottery, operating out of both buildings. This building more or less did the longer trip down to Rothrock's Mill, and the other building, the old Blue River Marina building, which was a very little tiny building, we ran most of the 7-mile trips from Totten Ford down out of that building.
And it's a good thing that we did. I mean, it was very fortuitous that we were able to buy Paul out, because the second half, well, really all the way through the 80s from 83 on, most of the years were dry. And the canoe business was different back then. I talked to Sherry about this, and And those were the days when baby boomers were young. And they were the first generation of Americans who really got out. They started canoeing, whitewater rafting, rock climbing, and all these things that the World War II generation, they just looked at the river. Mm-hmm. I suspect, Gordon, you're over there where they could whitewater raft when you were in West Virginia, and probably at first nobody was even...
No, nobody.
They just looked at the beautiful rapids, and there they were, but now they go down them in rafts. And, but anyhow, lost my train of thought.
How it's different, the canoeing business.
Oh, back in back then, the peak of the canoe season was the week before Memorial Day weekend, the 3-day weekend, and the weekend after. And because everybody who came out was out for the exciting adventure of going down the rapids in the Blue River, because that was a new, relatively new thing. And so the peak season peaked early, but later in the year, then it got dry. And well, now when Sherry's doing a lot of business, we weren't doing hardly anything. And so if we hadn't had the two canoe rentals together and we're still competing each other, well, Paul had a more established operation. You know who would have went broke? Probably would have been us. And we were borrowing money at 10% to finance it. So.
Was that a lot of pressure to have all that debt on you and trying to grow a business? And
yes.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
It sure was.
I remember in, because I was physically running the cave day to day, and Gordon would come down on the weekends, you know, he was a great partner, but I had the day to day responsibility. But after buying the cave, and then we had developed the Dripstone Tour, and then there was oil crisis season, you know, gasless Sundays. And so, you know, we thought when we developed the second tour at the cave, it would be great. But with the oil crisis, we found ourselves, the first year we had the Dripstone open with two tours and a lot of people doing both of them, less customers than we did with one the year before. And it took a while to come back from that. So we were struggling somewhat to build the cave business up. And then we had two loans to buy Lambert and to buy Blue River Marina, and they were all high. I woke up in 86 and realized how much debt we had compared to how much revenue we had. I'd break out in a cold sweat. I told Gordon, I said, we got to digest this for a while. We can't do anything else. But, you know, we made it through. But it was tough for us. I mean, the 80s was all tough, and then the 90s was a lot better for the canoe, and it was great for the cave. And so that's when we really did well.
And we survived some big floods, both here at Cave Country Canoes and at Marengo Cave. I remember one flood when Jimmy Carter was president. The English State Bank in English was underwater. The safe deposit boxes were underwater.
Oh, wow.
And we thought maybe they had lost our loan.
You could help.
But the owner of the bank told us, he said, oh no, we took your loan up on the roof of the bank and we still had your loan. Of course, we were kidding about it. He was very sympathetic to our difficulties having the whole bank underwater.
That's
and here in Milltown, we survived some major floods also. And I don't know how we did it, but between Gary and I working together, we somehow overcame it all.
Yeah, well, we hadn't got into the canoe business. That flood was in 79, and that's when they decided to move the town of English up on top of the hill after that. But there was a big east-west band of water, so it didn't go way up in the upper part of the Blue River watershed, so Milltown didn't have near as bad a flood as Marengo and English did. Mm-hmm. But it was, when the president, if you think, usually publicity of any kind is good for a business, but when Carter flew in a helicopter at English to look at the damage, I mean, this was like in early July, in Labor Day weekend, people were still calling his is the water out of the cave. Well, we were open the next day, but it ruined our summer, and the bank had to help us out with interest only and all to get through to the next year. So it's just, you know, there's a lot of trials and tribulations for anybody that's thinking about doing a small business. There's those unexpected things that come up.
Right? Well, sure. And it's amazing. I mean, nowadays your banks won't even work with you like they did with you.
Oh, no.
You know,
no,
so that's amazing right there.
No,
they don't have the power to anymore.
Yeah.
No, back then, character meant something when you got a bank loan. Mm-hmm. Now it's just collateral and credit, and character means nothing. But back then, character was a major, thank goodness, was a major consideration in getting money from a bank, which it is not anymore at all. I wonder how today Gary and I could not have done what we did, couldn't have come close to doing what we did. Chase Bank would have laughed us right out of the lobby.
Well, fortunately, when I developed Indiana Caverns, we worked with First Savings, which is after several mergers, it still comes from the English State Bank and had the same banker that we had at Marengo, and so it did help us, but yeah, it is a different day. They can't go out on a limb for you like before, but you know, it's a different world, but still, if you do business the right way, it usually works out.
A good example of that is right after we bought Marengo Cave, there was four of us, and there was a small piece of property adjacent to the cave down by the river that Pat Stevens and I thought was absolutely critical that the cave own this little piece of ground adjacent to it down by Whiskey Run. And Gary and Terry didn't think so much. So Pat and I said, well, by golly, we'll come up with the $2,000, which is all it was for the 2 acres, and buy that piece. Well, we didn't have any money at all, so we went to the Marengo State Bank, Pat and I, and we talked to the president of the bank, and we talked and we talked and we talked about pork bellies and other things, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And when we got all done, the guy hitched up his suspenders and leaned back in his chair, and he said, did you want cash or would you like a check for the $2,000? We said, oh, a check would be fine. And that's the way business was done back then. There was no credit checks, or God forbid there was no credit checks then, because we had just borrowed everything we owned to buy the cave. And we got the $2,000, and we eventually combined it into the corporation years later. And thank goodness we bought that 2 acres, very important two acres. Mm-hmm.
So all of your risks that you've taken have always paid off.
Well, yeah, thanks to working 8 days a week.
We had individual failures, but we had enough successes to overcome things like the swimming pool. which I swear it had walls made out of tissue paper. All we did was patch holes in that sucker for 30 years or whatever.
And we finally bulldozed it in.
Was it a challenge to get all of the wives on board with all of this risk and this debt?
I wasn't married, so not
for me. You were good then.
I was married, and I had a good partner. She went along some way, and a great partner, and she went along with it. Thank goodness.
It's amazing, too, that you all have stayed friends all these many years. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Our two kids were brought up at Marengo Cave behind the cash register in a bassinet because my wife worked at the cash register
Gordon's wife was the only, with the four of us that started, Judy was the only one that really was active, and she worked really hard. And the whole time that Gordon and I were partners for 28 years, Judy was in there pitching, and I didn't get married until 81, so then Laura helped after that, but Pat's wife and Terry's never worked there
at all. Judy worked behind the cash register a lot, and our kids were in the bassinet behind the cash register, so they both were brought up in the cave business, I guess.
And once we got in the canoe business, then we left Judy and Laura running the cave. And Gordon and I would come over here on Saturday mornings, and, you know, we'd start hauling canoes up the river at daylight and putting them out and stacking them up there to go. And then if once the rush was over at the canoe rental at 1 or 2 o'clock, then if it was busy weekends, we'd go to the cave, and our job, Gordon and I's job, was to park the cars coming in, because we didn't have a very big parking lot. We parked them all the way out the road and over in the cemetery by that. And then if there was going to be a big rush, then come running back to the canoe rental at 6 o'clock for the Spanish Armada coming around on the 7 mile to get them in. Right. And then some weekends, you're out there and there's reports of it's dark and it's almost 10 o'clock at night and you still got somebody out in the river. Do you just leave them or do you? And so it made a long day.
We still hear those reports.
Yeah.
Yes.
Some long days. Yes. Long, interesting days.
Yes.
How many close calls have y'all had in either one? Tell me some stories about caving or canoe in either one.
No close calls in the caving world that much, but certainly in the canoeing. We never sold alcohol, but obviously a lot of people took alcohol on the river. There's a liquor store here in town that did real well, I guess, with the canoe customers. And you drink enough, I guess it's amazing what you can do stupidly in a canoe or a kayak. And there particularly when we were started, our prices weren't high enough, and we attracted less than a high-level crowd, you might say.
Okay.
And once we got our prices up higher, then most of the drunks were not as nearly as much. At $25 per person, they were not nearly the problem they were at $10 or $15 a person.
Okay.
We attracted a higher level of quality of clientele, you might say. But back then, when we had to sell canoes at $10 a person on the river, we had a lot more problems and a lot more accidents and stupidities with drunks and ambulance runs and problems with the Department of Natural Resources. They were very helpful, but we had several drownings on the river. Which is always terrible, but in just about every case that were related to drinking on the river, which we had no way of controlling, we can't control it to this day.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a lot of excitement on the river, a lot more excitement on the river than there was in the cave, which is why we let Judy and Laura run the cave. And on Memorial Day weekend, took everything Gary and I had to run the canoe rental. So we let Laura and Judy run the cave and just hoped there was no emergencies at the cave. And most of the time there wasn't. The cave, nobody went in the cave drunk, and everything was guided at the cave. We're at the canoe rental, there was no guides, and we just were setting people out on the river. And a lot of people thought it was like King's Island, it was like a theme park or something, instead of a wilderness experience.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more exciting and a lot more problems at the canoe rental than there ever was at the cave. And of course, we knew the cave business a lot better than we knew the canoe business going in. We learned the canoe business pretty quickly, but...
The access to the places on the river when you have problems was difficult in a lot of places.
Still is.
Back then all the roads were gravel around it, and it's still, but there's places you can't get into the river for a couple of miles, up and down anyway. And so I can remember people, one thing, if you're married, And your relationship is not good, you don't want to go canoeing with your wife.
We talked about that one.
Yes.
Because they you get in fights, and I can remember stories of people come in at the 7 mile ramp and they say, well, there's a lady walking down the bank about 4 miles up. She refused to get back in the canoe with her husband. So we made more divorces than we made. I remember one couple got engaged on the river, but I think we made more divorces than the opposite.
Now, thank goodness for cell phones, they can't call us. And we try to talk them back in the boat.
That's very true.
But that probably is something people don't think about, especially if you've never done it before. You don't think about that you have to work together, mm-hmm. and you're out in the middle of nowhere. And they just don't think about that.
Well, if you and your wife have a relationship where you where you get, I don't know, you know, you nag testing. Each other. Yeah. Then you need to take two kayaks. Yes. We didn't have that luxury back then. Yeah.
Right. But to the kayaks, our kayaks are only single-person kayaks, and there's a big reason for that. It's one thing to have a husband and wife in a canoe and have to coordinate, but with a two-person kayak, it is really bad, because there the two people really have to coordinate to get the kayak down the river. So we essentially have never had any two-seat kayaks. We've always said that if we did, we'd have to offer divorce insurance with a two-seat kayak. Right? If you think a canoe's bad, a two-seat kayak would really be bad. So we only offer single kayaks.
Now, why is a kayak harder and worse?
Well, you have to paddle. You have to be coordinated in your paddling of a kayak.
Okay.
Where a canoe, you can, you know, the person in the front can just sit there and do whatever they want. The person in the back controls the canoe until they hit the rock. And then they yell at the person in front.
Because they didn't see
it's
the
their
rock.
Fault. It's their fault, of course, that they hit the rock.
Right.
Even though the person in the back controls the canoe almost totally.
It's kind of like the old, when you see in the old Roman and Greek days, and they had big banks of oars on each side. All those guys had to be perfectly coordinated so their oars didn't hit. Well, you got two people with a double-bladed paddle, one behind each other. It's more like having a jousting fight if you're not in sync.
That's true. Was a canoe, the lady is normally in the front, so he can sit there and read a book. Uh-huh. And the person in the back, if he or she knows what they're doing, can control the canoe down the river just fine.
Okay.
When did kayaks come to Cave Country, canoes?
Slowly.
Slowly?
I would say by the end of the late 80s, we were starting to get a few. You know, maybe a half a dozen years in or something like that. And then it just grew all through the 90s.
Were they plastic?
Yeah, all plastic. Absolutely. No such thing as more or less as aluminum kayaks. Mm-hmm. Then they were all sit-in kayaks initially. There was no sit-on kayaks. Mm-hmm. So they were sit-in, and then eventually they went to the sit-on kayaks.
Mm-hmm. And they had initially it was hard to get one where the bottom would hold up any length of time at all.
Right.
The plastic same way, too thin?
Well, yeah, and a lot of them have a rod in the middle, and where that rod, I mean, the Blue River is not the most forgiving river on equipment, because you've got these rock ledges with right angle bends, and when you go over one of those, I mean, whether it's the plastic or it was the aluminum with the rivets, I mean, it's a big rub, you know, there, and if you've got if you have a river like they have up in Michigan with nice round rocks, you don't have the same issue. But the upside of that is where you have those rock ledges, you've got a kind of an exciting rapid, mm-hmm. where in the other rivers you don't have as much of wave action when you go over them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it started, we went from the canoes with the rivets, which were in ribs horizontally across the canoe, to canoes without ribs, had a little bit heavier bottom, and they lasted with no ribs. We didn't have all those rivets to have to use the silicone caulk on, and they held up a lot better with the heavier aluminum with no ribs. And then we went from there to the plastic canoes. The Old Town Discovery canoe was the first ones we used, and they were a disaster. They lasted in not months, but weeks before we rubbed through the bottom of the original Discovery plastic canoes, which were made out of a plastic called ABS. And multi-layer ABS plastic, and they didn't last at all. And we worked with Old Town, and eventually they got better and better. And till today, the canoes have cross-linked plastic, and they last a long time. A lot of the problem was when you have 100 aluminum canoes and 2 plastic canoes. Well, the people wanted to use the plastic canoes all the time. Well, obviously, the plastic canoes got a lot more wear on them than the average aluminum canoe. So by definition, those two canoes wore out a heck of a lot faster than the average aluminum canoe. This was somewhat solved over the years by getting more and more and more plastic canoes. So the wear on any individual canoe was a lot less. Mm-hmm. And I think that continues to today when we have hundreds mm-hmm. of plastic canoes and there's less wear on any individual canoe.
But it was probably, what, 2010 by the time you got rid of the last aluminum canoe or something?
More recent than
2020.
That. Yeah, yeah, we still had canoes.
So it, mm-hmm. so it really took 30 years to transition because the plastic canoes had to be replaced every year almost, and the aluminum, I mean, those Alumacraft ribless canoes would last forever.
Forever.
Take four people to lift them, but
The transition, that's an important transition from the aluminum canoes with ribs to the ribless aluminum canoes to the early plastic canoes to more and more percentage of plastic canoes, where today we're 100%. Our canoes are all plastic, and of course the kayaks have always been all plastic, and over the years they've gotten a lot better.
They're very repairable. They're more repairable
now. You can weld them. I mean, it was probably harder to transition here at Cave Country than anywhere else in the country because of those limestone ledges. Rivers that were more forgiving could transition much quicker to all plastic than we could here.
Mm-hmm. And then also with the kayaks, we more or less had to design our own kayak, especially the sit-ons, because the sit-on kayaks that you buy with the black seats and the hatch covers, etc., were just not acceptable at all for the rental business. They weren't made for the rental business. So we finally got together with a kayak company in Sparta, Tennessee, called Jackson Kayaks. The owner of the company was Eric Jackson, who was an Olympic kayaker. And we, using the Spirit model, that an old kayak that Old Town no longer made, we designed our own kayak with Jackson Kayaks. And essentially it had no moving parts. So the seat was molded in, and there was no flimsy seat, no hatch covers, and no bungee cords and all that stuff that we didn't need. Even at the front and end of the kayak, instead of the little tiny ropes that they used to have to lift them from each end, there was a molded-in handle on each end of the kayak. So it was no maintenance, no moving parts, meant no maintenance, mm-hmm. and they've sold thousands upon thousands mm-hmm. and thousands of kayaks of that design to liveries all over the world. And we continue to buy them by the truckload. And they've worked out very, very well over the years. They've been very well accepted by the public. Anything in kayaks is, I've always thought, is comfort. I rented a sea kayak once with a flimsy black back and went out for an hour. And I couldn't wait to get out of the kayak. And I brought it back in, and the guy said, if you want to take it out for another hour, you can. I said, you couldn't pay me $1 million to sit in this kayak for one more minute. So the customers have to be comfortable in the kayak, so they enjoy the trip, and they'll come back and do it again. And then our kayaks are extremely comfortable, and you can paddle them for hours, and your back won't hurt.
And they're easy in and easy out. The sit-ons are really easy for impaired mobility. I mean, you can really get around in them.
And they're really stable. You have to work to dump yourself out of a canoe. We use them in Indiana Caverns in our deep darkness tour because you have to go down a 93-foot ladder to get and then go back through the cave, and so the kayaks stay in there all the time, and that river will flood. I mean, all the way to the ceiling sometimes, and so we just keep the kayaks back there on a cable, and they get beat around, and as the water comes through there, and you just come back with a rag and wash off the seat and jump in it on the next trip. And they've been down there for about 8 or 9 years, and then they no maintenance at all.
That's interesting. Are you guys both still caving and canoeing today?
Yes and no. I still go to show caves all over the world, but not wild caving anymore, not caving in undeveloped caves. I'm 81 years old and just don't have the stability, etc. I have two new knees, and they're fine, they're great, but I could still crawl with knee pads, but I don't. I just don't. I just that part of my life of cave exploring, which was a major part of my life, is behind me. Now, as far as canoeing and kayaking, yes, I do that, but the big problem is getting in and out of the boat. I need a helping hand, you might say, to get in and out of the boat. But other than that, I just do fine.
Still love it. Kayaking.
Yeah,
what about you?
I was actually in a cave on Wednesday, but I don't do a lot. It was we go out and look for caves with a friend named John Benton, and we'll go out and the main thing is to go out, hike around, and find them. And then we get there and we crawl in for like 100 feet, you know. So I don't do a whole lot anymore. I caved up until we developed Indiana Caverns in the Binkley Cave, but then when I was about 65 or 66, you had to kind of start slowing down. I'm 75 now, so I'm just barely going into them here and there now, you know. My back is stiff and sore from throwing all those canoes.
It's taking a toll.
It wasn't all the caving. It was the canoes. If I get, aluminum canoes.
If I get in cold water, I'm like having a 6-foot steel rod. You know, I don't bend very well anymore.
Uh-huh. Do you kayak anymore?
A little bit once in a while. I don't I don't come down here very often. I go on Indian Creek over by us a little bit, and Laura and I, we went to Glacier National Park about 3 or 4 years ago, and there was a river there next to us it's a fairly easy river for rafting trips, but they rented 2-person inflatable kayaks, and Laura and I, we were the only people, everybody else was in a raft, and Laura and I went down the river in an inflatable kayak, and we didn't dump. So.
And you didn't divorce, ever. No. So you did good.
I think both of us had good paddle partners. That, I mean, I can remember early on one time where my wife, I dumped her out. It was my fault. She stood on a rock in a river in Missouri and complained bitterly. Gordon was on that trip. He remembers that one. That's the only time.
Jim Richards was on that trip, too. He was really scared that you and Laura were going to get divorced. Yeah,
we hadn't been married very long. She'll still tell you that's the only time he ever dumped me.
Well, what do you guys like to do now as far as leisure, free time? What's your thing now?
I run a museum in Kentucky for show caves. And so I spend most of my time curating, et cetera, and collecting things for the show cave, and postcards, prints, books, things like posters, things like that for the museum, which is at Diamond Caverns in Park City, Kentucky, right at Mammoth Cave. And,
okay.
And Diamond Caverns has been open to the public since 1859, and I'm managing partner there. And the museum is right there on the grounds of Diamond Caverns. So I spend... We have a home in Park City, Kentucky, so spend a lot of time down there doing that. And travel a lot overseas, Portugal, just saying, I just came back from Portugal and the Canary Islands and Gibraltar and Spain, visiting caves as well as just scenic attractions. I still have a lot of places on my bucket list, and time is short. Not buying any green bananas, so I'm trying to get as many things off my bucket list as I can.
Good for you. What about you, Gary?
Well, I developed Indiana Caverns in 2013 and ran it for till 2019, and then I stepped down. I'm no longer the managing partner, although Laura and I are the main owners, and. I just finished writing my autobiography.
Nice.
And which is pretty much a cave book. I mean, the canoe rental's definitely in there too, but it's the Indiana Caverns is part of the Binkley Cave system, which is the longest cave in Indiana, and it's still one of the 10 longest caves in the United States. And so a lot of my life from the age 20 on has been related to Binkley Cave in the survey project. And so when I retired, I thought, well, I want to write my autobiography, but I also want to write a book about the second half of the exploration of Binkley Cave, because there's been 20 more miles found in the last 10 or 15 years. And But I decided I didn't have enough energy left to write two books, so I made them. I rolled them into one, and I'm not sure how that's going to work out because it's up on Amazon.com right now. It's called The God Project: The Improbable Journey of a Man Who Loves Caves. Okay. If anybody's interested in buying it, my name's Gary Robertson. They can search under the title or my name and find it on there.
Very cool. Very cool.
All didn't right. disappoint, did
you? No. Well, I tell you what, Sherry, why don't you give us a phone number here at Cave Country Canoes if anybody wants to come out now and explore and experience all this.
Yes, 812-633-4806.
And when are we going to be open for this season?
We hope to open weekends in April if Mother Nature so permits.
Okay. All right. Well, Gordon, Gary, Sherry, thank you all for coming in today and sitting down and talking with me. This has been fun. And thanks to all of you for listening to Out of the Blue podcast here at Cave Country Canoes. We hope to see you soon. Everybody go out and have an awesome day.